Hi, it's great to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart. Well, he's an Australian institution. Ross Giddens has been economics editor of the Sydney Morning Herald for 40 years. He has a devoted readership from high school economics students to Reserve Bank governors and federal treasurers. And he's just published his memoir. It's called Giddens, A Life Among Budgets, Bulldust and Bastardry. He came into CPX recently to talk about the book and about the wisdom he's gleaned from a long career as Australia's favourite economics writer. Ross, great to have you back in.
I'm pleased to be here, Simon.
Now, congratulations on the book. Now, we've spoken to you in the past about a heap of things, happiness to the limits of capitalism, and you write about lots of things. This book, though, it seems to be all about you. Is this your memoir? What's
going on? It is my memoirs, yes. I'm not about to retire, but I had a lot of things I wanted to say, I wanted to put on the record. A lot of it is anecdotes, but as you get towards the end of the book, more of it is analysis of how journalism's going, about the future of journalism, how it's going to cope with the digital age and all of that stuff.
As we think about this career of yours, 40 years doing this, 40 budgets, 16 elections, 13 treasurers, 8 prime ministers, and you know, forgetting the state level, and a number of Fairfax editors. I wonder if you could just make a comment to begin with on the ways in which you've seen Australian society change fundamentally, perhaps when it comes to politics.
Well, the economy's changed a lot, obviously, but the politics has changed. And I hope I don't sound like I'm just an old fogey when I say that I think that political standards, which probably weren't all that high, and it's a mistake to think that everything used to be really good, but I think standards of political behaviour have declined, and I think they've declined pretty much over the 40 years that I've been watching very closely. And I think that's a long history of politicians making promises, election promises, that they don't intend to keep, of politicians saying things that are really tricky, where they can say, well, you thought that's what I meant, but I really meant this. When what they originally said had been crafted to make you misunderstand them and to give them an out later after the election. And then they wonder why a politician who's done all these things to help him stay in office, then they say, people have stopped listening to him. I wonder why.
Now, you're a fairly optimistic person, though. So do you have moments where you think, no, but there's a way out of this? It feels kind of gridlocked. You know, the media cycle plays into this as well, doesn't it?
It does. And I think there's a symbiotic relationship between the media and the politicians. I think between them, they make it worse. I am an optimist and I don't give up. And I do think it's possible for us to have an improvement in the standard of political life. That improvement will start when the politicians realise they've hit rock bottom, where they realise they have very little credibility, that nobody has much trust in either side, and they have to start the very long process of rebuilding our trust and our confidence in them to be reasonably straight, reasonably honest, to not make promises that they aren't very confident they can keep. And if they make a promise that they're not confident they can keep, they ought to add the qualifications at the time.
Now, you acknowledge in the book that you failed macroeconomics for the first time at university and commerce stats twice. I'm sure if I'd done commerce stats, I would have been with you. And then you started as an accountant. How on earth did you get to this position of being such a popular, important economic journalist?
I did a lot of courses in economics at university, but I did become an accountant. When I arrived at the Herald many moons ago, I was an accountant. I happened to arrive at a time when the editors of Australia were just suddenly realising that the biggest part of politics was actually economics, and they needed a lot more people who are capable of writing about economics, and they needed to find them in a hurry. And they said to me, you're an accountant, economist, pretty much the same thing, isn't it? You'll do. And I have spent most of the subsequent 40 years boning up on the topic.
Well, I think you've done it very well. The book talks about some of your many wins, and there's been plenty of them. You've got, you know, governors of the Reserve Bank taking direction from you and all this sort of stuff, but you also have many failed predictions. Now, I wonder how much ego is required it to do the sort of job you've done?
I think there's a lot of ego in journalism, and the people at the top whose faces you're most likely to recognise are heavily driven by ambition and ego. But I'm not so egotistical as to believe I wrote a thing saying the Prime Minister should do X, and a month later he did X, therefore he did what I told him to do. The world's a lot more complicated. And if I was telling him to do that, then probably his own advisers were telling him to do it, and he did it more because of their advice than mine. So I don't delude myself on that score.
Do you feel like you know your audience? You've had this, you've been in this for such a long time. Lots of people feel like they know you, but does it work the other way?
I think I've got a reasonable feel for what my typical reader is interested in and not interested in. I write for the ordinary, well-educated person, doesn't have a degree in economics, knows that the economy must be a pretty important part of politics and important part of our daily lives. And so if they can find somebody who can help them understand that without too much stress and strain, then there'll always be a job for me.
And I'm sure that's what marks out your writing as distinct. Another thing that might be part of that would be the fact that, unlike perhaps some economists, you recognise that while the economy is very important, that there's more to life than this. Is that an important part of your writing as well?
That is the most important thing that I have discovered in 40 years of writing about the economy. I don't know quite when in the 40 years it happened, but eventually I realised that the economy was important, but lots of other things were important, and that in the modern world, in a very materialist world, a hyper-materialist world, a world in which we take the material more seriously than we might have done 50 years ago, the huge danger is saying, let's just mould everything on the basis of we all get richer. And I think that's crazy. I think it's dangerous. And it gets it all the wrong way around. The economy has got to be for people. It's got to make people better off. And if it sacrifices too many people in the process of making us all richer, there's something wrong with it. And we should stop doing that. And I also think that politicians should stop getting all their advice from economists, and occasionally they should consult psychologists, sociologists, even prelates, even religious people have got something to say about how you line up your values and how you make sure you run the country in a way that's good for people.
Yes, and as you've watched the economy ebb and flow a bit over the years, we've remained a very wealthy community. What do you think of our attitude to things like foreign aid and the seemingly endless cutting of that these days? Like we somehow managed to convince ourselves we're under threat and we're in danger of poverty ourselves.
You've said it. That is the amazing thing. We are one of the richest countries in the world per person. We've had a hugely successful economy for the past 20-odd years. It's been 24 years since the last serious recession. Very few, if any, other rich countries can say that. So we've been hugely successful. We've had the big resources boom, which all of us have got a share of, in strange ways, like a low dollar means I took a lot of overseas trips. Guess what? You got your share of the resources boom. So we are really a very rich country. We're a very fortunate country. We've done surprisingly well in the rough times before and after the global financial crisis. And yet we tell ourselves that we couldn't possibly spare any money for all those poor people overseas. It's really just pure selfishness that says a rich country like ours can't afford to help poor people in other countries.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith, and today we're bringing you an interview with Ross Gittins, longtime Fairfax journalist and economics editor and author. His new book is just out. It's called Gittins, A Life Among Budgets, Bulldust and Bastardry. Now, you speak very warmly about your growing up in the Salvation Army. Your family was very much in the Salvos. You were an officer's kid. And you describe yourself as a backslider these days, but you trace a lot of who you are and the way you work to that background, don't you?
Look, I think that every Australian, because Australia, like other Western countries, has been at least nominally Christian for centuries, I think the Christian ethic is deeply ingrained in the way we run our society. But when you've grown up in the church, like I did, it's kind of even more deeply ingrained. And I would like to think that subjects I write about, the things that I think are important, the policies that I say are good, the policies that I say are bad, are influenced not by me being on one side of politics or the other, but by a set of values which are essentially Christian morality. Hard, if not impossible, though it is, to live up to the ideals that Jesus laid down.
Now, when you think, though, as having had that experience as a child and then had a kind of, you know, warmth towards it anyway these days, that experience of being a believer, it's increasingly strange in our culture today. What do you think is the most attractive thing that a believer has and then brings to the society?
Honesty, a great reluctance to lie to people. I hope that my parents have left me with that.
Yeah.
It's pretty important.
Mm. Now, your Easter column every year, it's become a bit of a tradition, and this year was about Jesus as the great debt eliminator. Now, how do people respond to those columns, which are a bit different from the normal ones?
You don't get too many economic commentators who write about Jesus to do with anything.
That's right.
And you can see my Sally background coming out on Easter Monday, which I take as a kind of license to write about the links between economics and Christianity. I've been exploring those links from one Easter Monday to the next, and there are more links there than I realised. And I just enjoy that. It's a change of pace. It's a public holiday. When people are relaxing on a long weekend, they don't necessarily want more of the same. They wouldn't mind something a little bit off the wall. And so I get away with it.
Well, we'll continue to look forward to your Easter sermons every year. And then, Ross, towards the end of your book, you give a bit of a snapshot for a plan for effective journalism to continue even in this digital age, which is, you know, it's in a bit of a crisis. Are you able to give us a kind of a summation of that, or at least some of the high points of how you think good journalism can survive?
Good journalism can survive by being more active and less passive, by not just passively passing on the messages of vested interests, politicians, businesses, whoever they are, who just want to use the media to achieve their own ends. Journalism that doesn't have an adequate ethical compass says, oh, this guy's predicting the end of the world. That's a great story. Let's run with that. Do I believe that the world is coming to an end? Of course I don't. It's just a great story. Well, that is an ethical failure. One of the things I believe is that the media has to improve its credibility by not just happily running sensational stuff that's coming from people who are trying to twist a politician's arm and just foisting it on our readers, knowing that it's probably not true. We've got to play our part in the debate, and we can't censor everybody, but we don't have an obligation to pass on to our readers stuff that we're pretty sure isn't true or which is just simple assertion. We can do better than that. And one of the things I believe is that investigative journalism shouldn't be something that's given to a couple of blokes sitting over in a corner. It should be something that every journalist does and says, the opposition has said this, the government has said this, but we've talked to some of the experts and they say, no, that's not quite right. Now, that is serving the reader, and that is my ethical compass as a journalist. Do the right thing by the reader and you shouldn't go too far wrong. And that involves nobody misleads my readers that I know about.
So ethical journalism and economics with a soul. It's great to get your contribution in all of that. Ross, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Simon.
Well, that was Ross Gittins, the economics editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and the author of his memoir, Gittins, A Life Among Budgets, Bulldust and Bastardry. That book's out now. It's great to have your company on Life and Faith. See you next time.